Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by two One Heat Minute Productions. The first, Ingram Advice, 45 episodes, deep diving on Paul Thomas Anderson's 2014 masterpiece based off Thomas Pynchon's novel Inherent Vice called Ingram Advice, hosted by Travis Woods, produced by myself, Blake Howard, and narrated by the awesome Kat Corbett, takes a myriad of unbelievable guests through this sort of stoner noir masterpiece. Megan Abbott, Jordan Harper, Drew McWeeny, Matt Zoller-Zeitz, Walter Chaw, Karina Longworth, Ryan Johnson. Get listening. And if you're into fiction, it came from the deep. Maria Lewis, the host of our Josie and the Podcats podcast, is here with her very own audiobook, It Came From the Deep, and an after show co-hosted by myself. That's in its own feed. It Came From the Deep, Ingram Advice, search them wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's get to it.
Who got black top shirt?
What's up?
All bad.
Who's that?
All bad.
Hey now.
What the fuck?
Hey, yo, lesson here, babe. You come at the king, you best not miss.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. 128 minutes into Robert Redford and Alan J. Pakula's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. And we are leading in to the final deep throat scene of the movie. An absolutely pivotal scene that so far with Deep Throat, he's been a cagey man, but right now he's much more candid because the situation has called for it. There are literally only 10 minutes to go in this entire film to credits, actually less, about 9 minutes and 40 seconds. And it would be remiss of me not to get one of Australia's best voices. I stumbled on the best way to describe her, literally talking to her before the show, which is kind of like the grand dame of Australian film criticism and writing. And also such
should an, I thank you for that? I don't know.
I think you should because no, but also in Australia, we have a couple of really big film festivals. One of them is the Melbourne International Film Festival that's been doing a great thing for, I don't know, about 5 or 6 years now called Critics Campus, where it's sort of fostering curating brilliant and new and diverse voices in film criticism in this country. And this person has been a huge part of that. They've also written for the biggest and probably one of the best culture sections, despite the fact that it's under the Murdoch umbrella, that has been curated around in the Australian, has also written for a bunch of different places, but the Australian Film Journal Cinema Papers as well, probably most notably, and has been a guest of One Heat Minute Productions before, was on One Heat Minute, and it feels so appropriate to get her along for All the President's Minutes. Philippa Hawker, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Blake. I'm very glad to be back and at what a moment too.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. I love, love, love getting a message from a few of the guests in this part of the film that I've reached out to, such as yourself. And it's like, wait, Blake, can you just confirm, is this a Deep Throat minute? Like, is this like, are we in the garage with Deep? Yes, we absolutely are. And it's really nice. And, you know, we're rolling to the end of this thing, and we're rolling to the end of 2020 and this crazy year. And this crazy world is, you know, I think we're finally ready for the reprieve of getting to the end of this year. And this project has been insanely thrilling to be a part of. And it's great to have you along.
Oh, very, very glad. And as you say, it is this extraordinary moment. I'm sure we'll go into it in more detail now, but it's sort of almost, I mean, when I've watched the film a couple of times in the last couple of days, and you get to this, I mean, knowing that my moment, my minute is coming, but also thinking, my God, it's such an extraordinary sort of, as you say, we're so close to the end and so many things have happened and gone right and gone wrong, but everything's gone wrong. And yes. You realize, and I so much love, I know I can't talk too much about the ending, but I really love, one of the things I love about this film is the extraordinary sort of the minutiae, the detail, the yes. sort of tactility of it, the way everything's very tangible. I love how much paper is in this film. But I also really love these deep throat moments, as you say, where we kind of go down into the bowels of the earth, down into the underworld, into this sort of dark, mysterious place. And we never quite know what's going to happen there. I mean, it's such a clever thing. When you've read the book, there are many more deep throat moments, and you get more of a sense of, you know, who he is. Well, not his identity, but just a bit more about how he operates as a human being. But in the film, he's like a manifestation more than anything else.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to occupy the same rules as everything else. And like you said, it's the aesthetics are doing all that heavy lifting for you, even unconsciously as a viewer, which is brilliant, because like once Redford interacts with him, don't talk to me like this. And then he gets the note in the New York Times and he has to put in the flag in the pot plant. It's not just simply knocking on someone's door and hoping that you convince them to let you in. It's not just simply ringing around to some really reliable sources and them giving you information, or at least being willing to sort of, confirm something if you're on a hunch, or if you to keep you on the right track. This guy has a manner about him that, like you said, there is a, and I want to really underscore it, is there is such an unpredictability. Even though, like me seeing this movie countless times now, I love the feeling that I get of it's unpredictable every time we're going to see him, because in the, especially contrasted with the two previous scenes that he's had, lengthy scenes, he's kind of like gone, I'm not giving you this information. I'm not giving you this information, and danced around facts. And so like now at the moment of truth, in many ways in the movie, it's like, what's he going to do? We don't know.
Yeah,
we don't know.
Absolutely. No idea whatsoever. Yeah. I must admit, I would find him. I if I were in any way in a position as a journalist having to deal with this man, I could not cope.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating. It's someone who wants to be, you know, it's really quite an interesting character study, because he's someone who knows but wants to know what you know and will only confirm in a way that he chooses. And but the hilarious thing, each scene has its different sort of opening and closing. And in this case, I love the way that that Redford's overslept, that
yes.
Woodward's overslept. And so the ultimate insult in a
it's
way.
It's your worst nightmare. Like this yes. thing gives me anxiety on a number of levels. The first is like, especially being a parent of two little ones, my worst nightmare is sleeping in. And especially in this entire project, just to go behind the scenes with you, Philippa, because we're in the same country. So it's really nice to be able to go same time zone, same country. You know, we can line up perfectly. But there's been many shows and you know, in 137 episodes where I'm like, all right, I need to set three alarms. if I'm talking to someone at 5 a.m. in LA, I need to, you know, there needs to be a 4 alarm and then a 4:20 and then a 4:45 just in case I sleep through multiple alarms because I'm kind of knackered. So like it's your worst nightmare. Like this is the most important moment. He sleeps through it. And there's one sort of like, I don't know if you had this experience, whether it's in school or in tertiary education, but there's something professorial, like, you know, and not like as in telling a prophecy, but like being, acting like a professor of like, you tell me what you know, and I'll tell you if you're on the right track.
That
makes you feel really small. Like, and I think that that's because you're like, oh God, I'm now put on the spot. And if I don't have the right answer for me, I'm just going to get roasted rather than get illuminated with anything new.
Mm. Although in some ways, I mean, it does almost in a way echo the technique that the two of them evolve to get things confirmed by people.
Yes.
You know, it's almost as if they adapt it. When people don't want to actually utter a name or technically give someone information, but it's you know, if they can offer it and you know, get a nod or something. So it's an interesting, like, the whole idea of how we exchange information, how we tell people what we know, how can we tell someone something without telling them, like the non-denial.
My favorite phrase.
All these ways of saying things without saying them or denying them, but in fact saying that they're true. Just this sort of complexity is there the whole time in the way information's exchanged and between people and between people who don't know that they're sources, between people who know that they're sources, all this sort of complex to and fro of language and exchange is sort of just there so often in the film.
Well, we have so much to talk about. I know we want to talk about your beginnings as a cadet journalist, being lived with a typewriter and at least the tactile experience. Yes. Number one, we also got some X-Files topics to discuss and a very interesting example of a kind of Woodward / deep throat relationship that happened in Australian politics in regarding sort of international potential espionage and watching how the government decided to, as our government often decides to do, which I try and bring up as often as I can on this show, to litigate journalists and not like people like insiders who are trying to bring out information that they think is for the good of the is in the best public interest and the government sort of siding with their institutions. So some great stuff that we're going to get up to. Philip and I are now going to watch it. It's 128 minutes into this film. So if you're watching it on the dial, it is going to be 2 hours and 7 minutes on your dial, up to 2008 minutes. If you're watching HBO Max, for some reason, there's a 15-second ad. You might have to watch from 2 hours and 7 minutes and 15 seconds up until 2 hours and 8 minutes and 15 seconds. But Philip and I are going to watch this right now. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about it.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let Haldeman slip away.
Yes.
You've done worse than let Haldeman slip away, get people feeling sorry for him. I didn't think that was possible. In a conspiracy like this, you build from the outer edges and you go step by step. If you shoot too high and miss, everybody feels more secure. You put the investigation back months.
Yes, we know that. And if we're wrong, we're resigning.
There it is.
Things don't look good at that moment.
No, they don't. They really don't. Especially because when his face is illuminated in this glorious, just barely spectral green hue, he looks pissed off. And the letting Holderman slip away is a dagger to the heart, and it hurts. It hurts for us as viewers and people who love this movie. And you're like, and especially also, there's a sort of rich integrity that they imbue the Woodward of this movie with in Redford, and perhaps it's the case of the Woodward at the time and the Bernstein at the time, which is if we're wrong, we're resigned. And it's just such a strange, it's sort of like an alternate timeline. This is the dark timeline. This is the positive timeline. But it's a really interesting moment. And again, the feeling sorry for them. Right now, it's being people being able to twist things around. That's the worst thing. It's the worst.
There is that line. I mean, the context is really different. But when he says, "If you shoot too high and miss," it makes me think, you come for the king, you best not miss. Omar's line. Why? But it is, I mean, it's said in a different spirit, but it is that whole idea that if you aim too high and fall short, it's over. You really feel that. And just before that, when Woodward sort of has entered, as we see the third time in a similar way, but when he walks away from the camera, kind of disappears into the black, it's almost like he's been swallowed up completely. It's quite an uncanny moment, because there is something very theatrical and high stakes at the same time about these scenes. They're hugely artificial, but they also feel they're built up all the time as, the guarantee people, because Deep Throat does get referred to every so often, apart from, when he appears. And there's always this notion that he is the ultimate reassurance, usually in some way, frustrating as he is. He's the one that knows. And so this is devastating. And of course, we've the previous scene has shown us a reassurance in a way that Bradley will back them, but it's still extraordinarily intense in this moment for us as viewers, to just because I think that's the fascinating thing. I wonder what it would be like for someone who hasn't sort of perhaps quite the familiarity with historical events. So, because for me, it works on, even though I know exactly what happened, and you'd feel the same over and over again watching it, but there's still this extraordinary moment of sort of sinking feeling that you've got here.
I think you hit the nail on the head, Philip, and I just want to tag onto the back of it, which is for the only time, and whether it's a direct corollary to the end of the last scene that they had together, which is the car screeching out of there quickly at night. And, from a very sort of non-paranoid person, it's like, I know how many times I've gotten home late from work and you jump in your car at a late night car park because, especially watching a film, and you just want to get out of there, and you sort of screech out of a car park, and you can sort of get out of there if it's just someone. A car screeching away doesn't necessarily mean it's someone, but in this movie, the entire paranoid energy means that's that. So when Deep Throat is coming back, there's that moment that there's another car where you followed. Mm. We've seen in the lead up to these moments that Redford's perhaps tradecraft to get to Deep Throat hasn't necessarily been the best. And then you get the brilliance of the fact that the Holderman situation went down, which obviously as we can see now, he's so infuriated by, but just the call, like over here, but there's no cigarette illumination. I think we're going to touch on that with X-Files, the cigarette smoking man being, literally cut from the same cloth. But in the other sequences, he's been able to light a cigarette to cue where he is in the car park or in the same, you know, in the same spot. And here he says, over here. And as you said so beautifully, like he literally is walking to be consumed. Like he's jumping off the deep end. There's no safety net of where this guy might be. And it is, there is this heightened sense of dread. And even once you've watched it over and over again, the tone of the whole movie is structured around these incredible moments where you're coming out of, I guess, what you would call like a tangible docudrama reality into exactly what you said, which is like an underworld. And so I love that swallowing. And I think that on digital, sometimes it cheats you. Like, I don't know if you have a good enough screen or unless you're playing it like a Blu-ray, like there's kind of like this fake ghostly, like you can still see him for just that split second longer that maybe on a beautiful 35 millimeter print at a cinema, it wouldn't do the same thing. But I love watching him get consumed into total darkness, because ultimately then when he turns up, you know, he actually gets to be bathed in a little bit more light than in the previous scenes. And Deathstroke's the one who's completely shrouded.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, and I'm sure, you know, you've talked about this lots before, but the contrast with the newsroom too, with that sort of, you know, the kind of hyper illuminated sort of newsroom is really something too. That makes that one, the dark place, you know, where, you know, you're meant to be getting your truth, but you're being, it's sort of like, I don't know, it's like going to see the Sphinx or something.
Yeah.
Or a Sibyl, you know, it's like this sort of mythological space that
absolutely
he enters into there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now let's jump out of the mythological and jump back into the highly illuminated space. Tell me how crazy it was to file a piece of culture writing on a goddamn typewriter. Like, how is it torture? Like, I can't imagine. It must be why you can sort of think of a story now and, like, you know, once you're focused on it, like, smash it out. But, like, tell me about the agony of, like, having to be so calculating with your words that a piece of typewriter filing wasn't going to be completely scribbled.
I mean, there were so many things, obviously, about the nature of journalism and research and inquiry and interviewing and certain sort of things like that, which haven't changed at all, and some other things that have been utterly transformed. But yeah, it's a little bit different. My experience of, you know, typing a story on a typewriter is a little bit different in that they seem to be doing it on those quite longish pages, whereas we had paragraph-sized pieces of paper, like,
oh really,
a green and yellow carbon, so each paragraph was a separate sheet of paper, and which you would then so you'd finish the story, you'd type your 10 paragraphs on these 10 slips of paper, and then tear them up into a white, a green and a yellow set of the same story. So that was, you know, and you were pounding away on a typewriter when the noise of the newsroom is really great, the way they've captured that. But yeah, it is interesting, and I think that scene where you see Bernstein go over and look at what physically pick up and look at what Woodward has written is a really lovely scene, because you get that sense of the words. I mean, paper from beginning to end is in the film, like, you know, that wonderful sort of opening scene with that opening shot of the, you know, incredible close up of the typewriter.
Yes.
He's smashing down. And then of course the end, which you'll talk about later on, again, paper and just paper notes, piles of paper, stuff in cardboard boxes, evidence, sort of, you know, having to go to the library and look at, you know, actual pieces of paper. it's the sort of physicality of finding pieces of paper, whether they're your own notes, like taking notes on and getting a notebook out. These things must seem incredibly exotic, I would think, to people, you know, now. They felt like that to me watching it.
It's there's a I'm loving that we're quoting some prestige TV in this chat. The first being Omar, which is one of the best pulls so far of the whole series. So thank you for that. But there's a great scene in Mad Men where Don Draper is talking about, he's like, in Greek, nostalgia literally means the pain from an old wound. It's a twinge in your heart, far more powerful than memory alone. And I think that, you know, I remember one of my mom like used to type on a word processor, which was like, you know, essentially like a glorified digital interface that pumped things out, you know, it looked exactly like a sort of digital outlay of a typewriter, like a tiny, like you could only see like two or three lines of what you're actually writing before it sort of started to print it up. And that was like my earliest memory ever of something like that. And that was in her job. She would type things up and send through faxes and whatnot. And I every bit of the paper in this, the entire concept of working and collaborating with people, especially writing, where people can pick up what you've done and some copy editor is going to read it, scribble on it, give suggestions, get it to be retyped. Like, that is just so thrilling to me. And it's just like, it hurts me. And I wasn't even around when you did it, but it's just every time you watch it, you're like, oh, there's just something about that tactile thing, being a complete physical media person. I can't get enough of it.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, the other part of it, you know, is what they can't do too with, I mean, imagine if they'd had the internet or mobile phones. I mean, many of the things, you know, like.
And for positives and negatives.
Some things would be harder. I mean, I think that, you know, you can get, they're all, I mean, it'd be really interesting. I've only sort of peripherally begun to started to think about that. I'm sure there are lots of ways in which, I mean, obviously you wouldn't have to ask who's Charles Colson. You just, you know,
you Google it.
Phone, you wouldn't be exposed.
You Google it on the phone. You Google it on the phone.
As you were talking. Yeah. There are, the sort of, on the other hand, I don't know, you know, people who are doing incredibly researched and difficult stories these days are no doubt, you know, reading reports and going to people's houses and having covert meetings. I mean, I'm sure there are ways in which what we're looking at is in All the President's Men is echoed by some of the sort of more dedicated deep dive journalists ferreting things out that, you know, that governments or businesses don't want them to know. But there are some ways in which this is a fascinating time capsule of, and I love the way that the film absolutely embraces it.
Yes, it's you know, the proximity with which they created this film to the events that had actually occurred gives them so much more luxury of you know, immediate references, you know. I've talked a little bit about the next project that we're doing, which is like Zodiac. And so it's really exciting to be doing that. But everyone who made that film, and I think Fincher and the screenwriter James Vanderbilt and the entire team, although they were using Robert Graysmith's book as the key foundation, you know, they used movie researchers to go and like scrutinize and research different things and try and find alternate sources, even though the basis of the script was the Graysmith book. Go find the different sources, go speak to living witnesses, go try and do that, because what they were trying to do is make sure that they were as rigorous and as authentic with all of the different voices. And they've got to go back 30 years for that information. So the people just aren't around, or people have passed away, or people can't be found because they've moved out of the country. And so you have all these things where it just seems like it's impossible. But here you've got the shorthand of like immediately being able to like just sidestep back, and the Washington Post newsroom exists. And some of the people who are in there.
They did recreate it completely, didn't they? But, they had a model.
They had a model.
They were able to create a completely convincing alternative universe.
So before we dive into Witness K, which I think is a fun topic for us to talk about, you wanted to talk, I believe you were... wanted to talk a little bit about X-Files, because it feels like in all these deep throat scenes and And I'm always very mindful of new people that are joining us, you know, because of our great guests. So if this is your first time listening, welcome. It's almost impossible for me to talk about The Simpsons or The X-Files when I'm talking about deep throat scenes, because as a younger person in Australia, especially, like, you know, the cultural imperialism of the American, you know, of American culture in all of our television, but especially The Simpsons, I think most of my key cinephile references were first experienced on episodes of The Simpsons well before anything that I ever actually saw myself or could get my hands on or even knew the text that they came from. So it feels like only right that we talk about, you know, The X-Files, and we talk about Cigarette Smoking Man with Deep Throat.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's funny, this year during COVID, I actually started with my daughter. We started watching The X-Files. Watching it again. I hadn't watched, I mean, she was watching it for the first time. So we were already sort of, we're at season 7 now. I was thinking about, Deep Throat anyway, even before this came out. So the fact is that Deep Throat is the combination of Deep Throat and The Cigarette Smoking Man. Yeah. is kind of fascinating. I think looking at The X-Files, I kind of appreciate it more now as a work about trust no one, you know. You have to work it out for yourself. And it seems like a very, even though there are some pretty out there kind of conspiracy theories that it espouses, there's also this really fascinating skepticism about government, about the law, and about having to, you know, establish everything. And even to think of Mulder and Scully as a bit of a Bernstein and Woodward double act.
Absolutely.
Two complementary talents,
and they get to also underscore the desire of that. You know, there's the tension where the male and female then can become sexual in the show. You know, of those two different personalities, like a rigid skeptic and a believer, etc. But I think I completely agree. I think the thing that resonates, especially in sort of the first sort of 4 or 5 seasons of The X-Files, is this I like to call it like the brilliant cynicism. Because even as crazy as Mulder is, and I want to believe, and he loves all these crazy little stories and their Monster of the Weeks, etc. It's a really brilliant examination of critical thinking. It's like two people that are thinking critically constantly, but also from within the machinations of, you know, a government organization that purports to be helping you. And it is always very, very healthily critical about government organizations, and that they're just controlled by people and just controlled by egos. And there's a lot of external influences that are trying to, you know, touch them up. And I think that's why those early seasons of The X-Files are just divine.
Yeah. Oh, no, they're beautifully, beautifully sort of imagined and worked out. And there's a sort of lot. I mean, things do get a bit bizarre from time to time.
Yeah.
But there's also this wonderful, really well thought out. I mean, watching the very first episode, the pilot, you think, oh my god, they've, you know, with hindsight you realize, you go back and you realize, god, that was so well worked out.
Yes.
There are so many just that very first glimpse of the Cigarette Smoking Man is like, oh my, you know, you suddenly see how much they've already put there, you know, laid down for you. And and I think that there's sort of, it's interesting too in All the President's Men, the different ways that the different attitudes towards knowledge and asking questions and getting answers, that that the different techniques that Bernstein and Woodward have, they're and they gradually do, I think they learn a bit from each other.
Definitely.
Bernstein is the more kind of bumptious sort of you know, he'll step in the door, he'll borrow a cigarette. I mean, the cigarette smoking, in fact, is quite a, like, you know, it becomes something that Woodward sort of is snooty about. But it turns out that it becomes a real, it's his way into the bookkeeper. is to get a cigarette from her sister, and you know, there are sort of
and Bernstein is never more he's the most Woodward in that scene.
Absolutely, it's like it's like he has learned something that he's more he behaves like.
Yes.
Yeah, like absolutely right. Yeah.
And later on there's that unbelievable moment where Sally Aitken starts talking about the Canuck letter, and Woodward like asks her a question. And when he asks her the question, it shocks Bernstein because it's almost like, did you say that or did I think it? You know, like, yes. He's like, did he tell you that to go to bed with him? And you're like, whoa, where did that come from? And it's those guys have those moments.
It's really beautifully timed because Woodward kind of walks away, then Bernstein can't believe that. Why didn't he follow through? But in fact, it was the right way to do it. But yes. They're definitely just as you, you certainly see them learning from each other. And that's really well done.
And the added dimension is like, you know, I think this film is so incredibly influential and powerful because of the economy of the storytelling and the focus. And here we're seeing, you know, you can sort of see the richness of Deep Throat's personality and his frustration with where they are. But it can only go to a point, obviously, because we're really only in a 2-hour thing, and there's so much that's going on, and there's so many players, and they're really trying to maintain the tight reins on this story, even though it's bouncing around and creating a constellation out of the dots, as the very awesome TV critic Ingo Kang sort of coined that phrase on this show, which I continue to use. I think that just one last thing to sort of close out our X-Files chat is, what's great about the cigarette smoking man is that his benevolent insights at the beginning of the X-Files series means that he's always kind of like on their side. He's a great person to sort of cut through, and he's very deep in the conspiratorial sort of, you know, world. But what's awesome is as the show evolves, his information becomes so much more deeply problematic, because it's like, why is he giving you this information? And actually the show does a great thing, which this movie has absolutely no time to do, which is scrutinize the why. Why does this person want to give you this information? Why do they want to do it?
But he also does want to, I mean, he's also incredibly dangerous. I mean, like, it's sort of,
yes,
he's incredibly dangerous as well. I mean, yes, he's to be, I mean, yeah, he may occasionally seem on their side. I mean, all of their inside people, it's the same. Deep Throat, not as much. I mean, he seems more benign. The cigarette smoking man, obviously more malign, and X, somewhere in between. And so they're all. I mean,
we're pulling from JFK.
It's really complicated. I mean, obviously, the cigarette smoking man is.
He's definitely part Deep Throat, part X. I think that's it. You're spot on there. That Donald Sutherland scene in Oliver Stone's JFK may be one of the greatest, you know, 7 or 8 minutes of montage storytelling in American cinema, especially in the 90s. Like, it's so powerful and so, I don't know, intoxicating to watch over and over again. It like really gets to the bottom of it. It's phenomenal. But I do have to ask, you asked me, and I often correspond with my guests about different topics that we're going to think about or different stuff that we're going to cover, and then we'll sort of let the conversation flow. But you brought something to my attention that I was so completely not familiar with that I spent time like researching, and now I'm in like a level of disbelief, and I'm so grateful to have you for exactly this reason, because I'd love if you could tell the listeners, especially a stack of them who are listening internationally, about Bernard Collery and Witness
K. Bernard Collery and Witness K. Yeah. Look, it's. I mean, I kind of hesitate to. It's such a complex story that I certainly, you know, would prefer. I mean, I'd like to think I could just sort of
give the gist. We'll do our best to give the gist.
I mean, what it is 2004. The Australian Secret Intelligence Service, ACES, they planted listening devices in a room next door to the Prime Minister of Timor-Leste's office.
Yes.
And reason they did this, they did it under the pretense that they're upgrading an office, and they actually did it so that Australia could gain an advantage in negotiating with Timor-Leste about oil and gas fields in the Timor Gap. And this is a country that had, you know, newly independent, in, you know, really vulnerable financially. And
yes,
Australia did this. And it became public knowledge. It was done under the auspices of Foreign Minister Alexander Downer. And it became public 8 years ago when a senior intelligence officer who had been very uncomfortable about the operation actually asked for permission to talk to a lawyer about it.
Yes.
And since then, I mean, you know, if there's anything that I've left out, by all means.
Yeah. I think you're spot on, but it goes so much deeper into the machinations of the case, the different individual politicians that are involved and what that potentially has, what ramifications that has, I think. But Philip has definitely given a good appetite.
And the thing about it is, absolutely, look, I mean, it's a clandestine operation against another country that basically for the, you know, the benefit of oil companies.
Yes.
And both Labor and Liberal governments subsequently have acted in extreme, you know, not in no positive way at all. The case has gone to The Hague. Witness A and Bernard Collieri, his lawyer, who was once an Attorney General for the ACT, I mean, quite a, you know, significant legal figure. There have been sort of dirty tricks like refusing Witness K, who's the senior intelligence officer, you know, cancelling his passport so he can't go to The Hague to testify. And I think it's a story that has been written about. There have been various publications that have done their best to get to the truth of it. A lot of it's happened in secret. Yes. Really is. I mean, the lack of public accountability and the secrecy is really distressing. And I think it's just, it's a story that's still going. If, you know, perhaps we could put some links to some stories.
Yeah, I in the description of this show, I'll make sure that I grab the best links. I'll do the basic stuff first, and you know, obviously the Wikipedia links, but then I'll make sure that there are actually individual stories that you can read. And exactly as you said, the crazier thing is that a story like this is playing out in such a way where someone thought, especially in Witness K, thought that the best approach would be to get permission to seek a lawyer because of how uncomfortable they were with the situation, because they thought that it was in the best interest for the public to know about it, or potentially thought we were breaking international law in doing so. And that impulse, I guess, or integrity to do something right in that moment has meant that it's sort of gone a bit haywire. And in this country, when people have asked things, you know, we've discussed along the way on the show, like, why doesn't Australia isn't having a Me Too moment as much? Why, you know, what's going on? We've been very careful in the process of this show to talk about, you know, there's a significant libel laws that are out there for different publications to face, for different individuals to face, that are much more stringent than that of America, because, you know, and particularly when, you know, the Australian Federal Police is, you know, breaking into the offices of our national broadcaster to try and get, you know, journalists to reveal sources, it's starting to get pretty serious and a bit draconian. Mm. And very, you know, for better or worse, the COVID-19 pandemic and all of the, you know, the shift of focus to, you know, the health and well-being of our population and the, you know, trying to bolster the economy to keep us buoyant during this insane time has stopped some of that momentum. But there's definitely plenty of journalists who is also very fresh in their heads earlier from the year and even late last year where these sorts of things were happening. And yeah, it's a crazy, it's like the quintessential example. It's a crazy story.
It's a really significant story that, it really deserves to be more widely known, I think. And I mean, a lot of, you know, I mean, there have been some very good journalism. I mean, I think that's one of the things that you sort of do ask yourself sometimes is the work is there, but people have put, you know, hours and hours and have worked incredibly hard and sources have risked a great deal. But why has a particular story, not transform. And I think we're asking ourselves that question a lot at this moment in time.
Yes.
These stories have appeared. They've been published. Why is there no? And I mean, we can all think of a score of stories this year in Australia alone, where we think to ourselves, why hasn't this made a difference? Why aren't people more outraged? Or why hasn't this outrage led to something more? And
I hate to be glib about it, because definitely not for the Witness K case, but it was something even as recent as revelations about Australian military personnel committing murder in wartime. SAS soldiers murdered, I think the number is 29 people, and you know, there's 39 people, and there was a whole swathe of stories and incredible, like, you know, journalism done to sort of to reveal that this had come out, to share this information widely. There was a PR campaign from the current administration in our country to like speak to the leaders of their countries and to preemptively apologize to make sure that it's not a bigger international incident than it could potentially be. And then Australian broadcast media, especially that kind of like dominates our political conversation, are running story after story of some Adelaide teen who's frustrated about being in lockdown for 6 days in COVID-19, and no one's covering the SAS story. And it's just like, what is going on? Why are we talking about one teenager in Adelaide when we should be talking about what is potentially a monstrous international incident about soldiers committing war crimes in another country and how we're going to have to fix that?
Yeah, I do think there has been quite a bit of coverage, but I guess the question is, and obviously too, I mean, there are stories of intimidation and of whistleblowers and journalists in the process of, you know, the writing of these stories too. I mean, that certainly happened.
Yes.
But, I think the question, I guess, now is what will happen next?
What happens next?
I don't want to preempt your discussion of you know, the ending of the film, but I do. Mm-hmm. One of the things I do really like so much about All the President's Men is the lack of fanfare and the absence of applause. It is really, I do not want to go in there and talk about things to happen.
Philippa, I just want to tell you, I'm giving you the green light for anyone who's seen on socials today. I announced the final minute, the 137th minute of this film. I'm going to be joined by Jane Alexander, the bookkeeper herself.
So exciting, the bookkeeper. Such a wonderful actor as well. I mean, she's got an extraordinary career, and it's one of her, you know, it's a pivotal role. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, in All the President's Men, that there are some, I mean, she's the significant woman, really, isn't she, in that film?
She's the woman, and, you know, she was an incredible stage actor. She then, you know, broke out and was Oscar nominated for, you know, saying the same performance she did on the stage, on the screen, for The Great White Hope alongside James Earl Jones. And she's absolutely incredible in that movie. And I also think that it's like a travesty that she never won the award, nor James Earl Jones for that matter at that time. She then comes into this movie. She completely knocks, you know, she knocks the movie out of the park. Like she's in the definitive scene. John Borson, who's
the real emotional axis of the film, isn't it?
That absolutely. Sort of, yeah. And so, you know, for me, the great Alan Pakula has passed. You know, I spoke to associate producer John Borson back at episode way back in episode 75 and 76 minute, but it was the 76th episode I spoke to John. And it was in the beginning of that scene because, you know, for John, who was so close to Alan and later wrote a movie with him and things like that, he was like, this is the scene of the movie. This is this entire film in microcosm, that, you know, there are real people that are putting their lives at risk and putting their livelihood on the line and putting their morality ahead of any kind of political allegiance, and especially women in doing that. And I think she's phenomenal. It's the most hypnotic scene. And I can tell everyone, I won't tell anyone about what we talk about, because you guys can wait for that. But I will just say I very rarely get starstruck, and I'm still recovering after speaking with her, because she's just such a wonderful and generous and sharp lady.
Oh, it's a wonderful performance. And God, they shot it in the actual bookkeepers.
This is what I wasn't sure with Jane. She says she's not sure if it was exactly that house. She said it was definitely a house in Maryland, and okay. where they shot it, like in Washington, where they shot it. It was a house. It was like not a set. This is where I'm getting conflicting things. I think it may have been just like they found a house that looked identical to her house, and then dressed it like Judith Hoback Miller's real house. It was the real bookkeeper in the film, and Jane does talk a little bit about that.
That's the value of doing something like this, is to actually to be able to nail that down and.
Yeah, so you know,
get the facts.
Follow the money.
Get the facts. Yep.
Philippa Hawker, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me on this show. I love talking to you. It's just a pleasure all the time to talk to you. I said it right at the top, but I'm such a huge admirer of you and your work, and it's just awesome to chat to you again. And I love even more that we got to throw in an Omar quote from you, which has made my heart very full during this, this episode. Yeah.
Thanks again, bye.
That was the incredible Philippa Hawker, an amazing and kind of fixture of Australian culture writing, especially around films, for many, many years. Film and arts writer all over the place, based out of Melbourne. If you want to follow her on Twitter, it's at Philippix, which is PhilippiCs. That's the best place to find her. Again, a huge thank you to her for being on the show. Guys, thank you so much for listening to the show. If you could, please follow, rate, subscribe, review, share the living daylights out of this show. That's the major way you can help us. If you also want to follow us, you can do that at oneheatminute.com, at ATPMpod on Twitter, for myself, @OneBlakeMinute on both Twitter and Instagram. And finally, if you want to follow us along and get a little bit of extra stuff, that's One Heat Minute is where you go on Patreon, where you get a bonus episode every week, me talking about different things. And for the upcoming project, Zodiac Chronicle, there's a bunch of bonus content coming around that show. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on another episode. Oh my God. Very, very soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.